Welcome to episode 24 of the Few and Far Between podcast, conversations on the cutting edge of clinical research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien, CEO of BioRossi. Today's guest believes that in order to create a better and safer world, you need warriors. Gaddy Lachman, president and CEO of Trinetics, has held the role of warrior and leader many times throughout his journey, including his service in the Israeli Special Forces. Today, Gaddy leads his team of scientists into battle against the massive data gap in life sciences and clinical research in order to improve both patient care and clinical trial efficiency. In this episode, I had a chance to talk to Gaddy about the evolution of data, the obstacles to sharing and refining real-world data, and the challenges of demystifying and sharing that information across the thousands of rare and orphan diseases across the globe. Get ready for an exciting journey to the point where data and analytics meet and connect to transform the clinical trial and healthcare industry into a better and safer world. Okay, without any further ado, let's start the podcast. All right, this is Chris O'Brien, your host for Few and Far Between. I am delighted today to be speaking with Gaddy Lachman. Gaddy, I have to tell you, I have been looking forward to this conversation for at least a week since our last chat. You are a fascinating guy and you sit at a really exciting intersection for healthcare and data as the CEO of Trinetics. So welcome.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. All right, well, listen, let's jump in and start a little bit with your pre-Trinetics life. So a thing that I have in my notes is ex-Israeli Special Forces. We are doing this conversation remotely. Thank God. I'm terrified by this, even this virtual proximity to an actual warrior. How did that develop for you? And tell us a little bit about your earlier experience before you got into healthcare.
Right. I had no life before Trinetics, but if I had anything before that, I can tell you a bit about myself. Thank you for being so kind, by the way. Maybe that was true 30 years ago. So I grew up in Israel. I joined the Special Forces. You have to serve in Israel. So I volunteered and became an officer, got a team. Interesting times, really liked serving my country. What an experience for an 18-year-old guy. A member of a team that has really the best people and very motivated, very driven. And then really honored to get the opportunity to go to Officers Academy, come back and lead a team and then a bunch of teams. Really humbling. And I guess it makes you grow up fast.
So this is something that some of our listeners may not be familiar with, is sort of how the system works in Israel. Will you take a second to explain? I know that everyone serves, but some units are considered more prestigious than others, harder to get into. You served in it sounds like a pretty elite unit. What was the process like as a young person applying, and how did all that work?
You have to want to be, I'd say, the area of the tip of the spear, if you will. And then they run a bunch of tests and you have to qualify versus a very large group that wants to get in as well. And I was lucky to get in. But a lot of people want to get in those places because if you have to spend 3-4 years in doing this, you do the math, you might as well do something interesting.
I bet interesting is an understatement. Obviously, as a CEO now, you face all kinds of interesting challenges. But when you think back, were those formative experiences, do those stand out as kind of harder or scarier than the kinds of things that you have to deal with in business life? Or are they just different? How do you think about all that?
It's all the fundamentals that make us as human beings. They apply in everywhere, in the army or in business or in real life with your friends or family. It's the same things. Things that teach you to push yourself and then others to the limit. And what is the limit? And discovering that what people think is their limit, actually, they can go much further. I guess 100% dedication to something, that definitely transfers into business. For me, Trinetics is everything. And 30 years ago, my team and their lives were everything for me. And, you know, the success of the missions, etc. So it's really the same principles, I think, also when it comes to leadership. You know, it's very interesting. When you go to Officers Academy, people that are average athletes, but not really extreme, when you let them lead the platoon or the team for the week where they practice being an officer, you can't catch up to them. They run faster than anyone else. But when they're normal, regular, you know, cadets or candidates, they run just like anyone else and maybe even less. So it's a very interesting thing to observe. People become leaders. It gives them so much power and strength. And actually, you have to be aware of that, that you don't run so fast that nobody is behind you. So pace yourself.
That's fascinating. So this is slightly off where I was going to take us, but because of where we've wandered in this conversation, as you think back on being that age, being a young person kind of coming up, or you think of people that you know or folks in your life, is there advice that you give or that you think is helpful to give to young people who are maybe interested in taking on some kind of a leadership role, but aren't certain if they are leaders yet?
Yeah. I think if you want it, you know that you want it from a very young age. I was always ambitious. I was always striving to be the number one in every class I've ever participated in. I knew it from a young age. I never let go. So I guess if you have that bug in you, I'd say you will know it. And then there's a lot of advice I can give, and I tell people to do the opposite of what I say, and then they will be very successful. But if I had to tell them, what, you know, just experience it and experiment with it. There's never a too young age to start, I guess, trying to assume all kinds of leadership roles or trying to test yourself in those things. But if you want it, you know that you want it. And if you want it, you're probably going to get it. And then the question becomes, what are you going to do with it? You're going to get the power, you know. Just don't. How are you going to use it for good? How are you going to be kind to people? How are you going to stay humble? Never forget where you came from. You know, all those things that people tend to forget. And that's the number one reason why eventually they may fail. So you're going to get the opportunities. I say take the opportunities or create them. Don't wait for people to give you things. But the most important thing, you know, they say, right, with great power comes great responsibility. It's true. It's really true. You're going to be in charge of the lives of people, of their livelihood, business decisions that you make. Going to determine if next year you're going to recruit or hire another 20-25% of the people or lay off 20 or 25% of the people. So you have so much more responsibility. I think the number one thing if I had to give people is to stay humble, keep listening. Don't think what you say is true just because everybody at some point start to want to please you and say yes. And, you know, this is the biggest trap. You're not smarter than you were. You're probably not smart at all. Just really stay humble and listen and be very, very open.
I love that. Have the confidence and ambition to try, but stay humble. There's a line that a guy that I used to work with used to tell me all the time. The Roman Caesars had someone who would stand behind them and whisper, "Remember, thou art mortal." I think that was before they became gods. But I think if it was good for the Caesars, it's probably good for anybody who's leading an organization. Okay, I'm going to fast forward us a little bit because you are an interesting guy with an interesting life. So we could spend a lot of time over those next few years. But I'm going to fast forward you to come into the United States. So you come to the U.S. to attend Harvard Business School. Is that right?
Yep. 2001, I promised my wife we're going to come to America for 3 years. 2 years to do the Harvard Business School MBA program and 1 year to work and pay for the debt and the loans I took to fund it. Little did I know that it takes more than 1 year, but that's I've been here for 21 years now, so it's been a fantastic ride.
You're 21 years into a three-year stint. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So coming out of HBS, did you know that you wanted to do healthcare? How did that all evolve?
That's a great question. I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up, right? Seriously. So I did HBS. I was a Baker Scholar there, which is the high distinction because I wanted to be the top of the class. And after that, I worked for a company that's one of the biggest bankruptcies in the history of mankind. It's to be called Lehman Brothers. A wonderful company, investment banking. I guess coming out of business school with no connections, no relationship with anyone in the U.S., you either go to banking or consulting, or at least that is how it used to be. So chose banking, great company, wonderful experience. I wanted to see Wall Street and I saw Wall Street. And you got to live through this for a couple of years to really understand how that machine works. And it's a business school after business school, I guess. From a level of intensity, everybody knows banking is just like military. It's a 24/7. So I felt at home. I loved the experience. I loved the learning. And I also realized it is not what I want to do for a career. There is little to no soul in that business. And it's important for me, the soul, you know, to wake up in the morning and know that you're waking up into an important day. And what you do is going to be important, not just for you, but for many other people. It doesn't feel like that. Again, a wonderful place and wonderful company, and the world needs Wall Street. It's where companies get capital and a lot of stuff gets done. But I knew after that, I really want to do something else. So look for a career in healthcare. Even though I'm not a physician, I'm not a clinician, I'm not educated in anything like that. Also wanted to move from Manhattan back to Boston. I just love Boston. I had a professor that said, decide where you want to live and then look for a job there. How amazing and hard that is, right? It sounds so simple, which obviously it's not, but it's so true. I really love Boston. So I looked for, and this is where I started my healthcare career.
It's great. I think sometimes the best advice we get, we're living in the details of our lives and our businesses, and sometimes someone can pop you up a level and reframe the way you're thinking about it, as the example you just gave showed. Yeah, I love it.
Absolutely. You know, Chris, the other thing he told the class, he looked at all of us and said, all of you, each one of you is going to get fired at least once in your career. So I'm still waiting for that, but I don't forget his words. I never forgot his words.
All right. So you come to Boston to start healthcare. Tell us a little bit about that.
So joined a bunch of amazing Israeli entrepreneurs. They had a company and it was the theme ever since. It's data and analytics and how you can create a lot of value from data and analytics in healthcare for patients. So they did that company in the field of in payer land, you know, basically collecting a lot of data from the payers in the U.S., and running it through their AI, ML to figure out who's going to get sick and could be managed better next year, giving it back to the payer so that patients could be managed, patients that are heavily sick, disease management done by the payer. And we were the technology infrastructure and the data and analytics for that. So lots of value created. We worked, I think, with all the major payers in the U.S., the Blues, you know, United, all those companies.
And so obviously that background, that experience must have made you pretty interesting to the team when Strinetics had been founded. Let's talk a little bit about that. How did that all develop?
All right. So and for many years, I saw all those things. So I saw the data and analytics make sense in payer. Then I was chief operating officer of a company that used technology to call on millions of Americans a day and have a conversation with them about their health. That's completely driven by a machine. Everything people said becomes a data point that's part of the disease management program for those sick patients that drives the next call. So it's a very data-driven way to interact B2C with members of health plans. After that, I built and ran a physician organization that's completely virtual, telehealth, for a telehealth company. This was amazing. This was 24/7. Access to real physicians licensed in your state that after a conversation with the patient could prescribe, if appropriate, the right medication for those patients. 24/7, 2-minute wait time for a physician. So it's unbelievable. You don't need to leave your home. You don't need to leave, you know, drive, wait, schedule, see a clinician, go back, lose a couple of hours at work. Literally 2-minute wait time. 10-minute, 15-minute conversation with a physician that actually sees you, and then, if required, will prescribe or recommend a treatment, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, this thing became super hot during COVID-19. And, you know, it doesn't replace a lot of the care that's being given to people, but it supplements it very nicely. You don't need to hit the ER for everything. And this is where you don't really need to hit the ER. So very nice. And you know, I hired a group of primary care physicians in the U.S., more than 25. We licensed them in 25, 30 states on average. And so they can provide services in all those states. And then we had thousands of physicians as 1099 if we need extra capacity. So it was a very large national network in the U.S. that can deliver services almost in any state. And then Trinetics. So welcome to the revolution that Trinetics is. I have never worked in the life sciences business before. This is my 9th year since we started this company. Trinetics is a very simple thing to explain. Very, very hard to do. We are basically are a platform for clinical research. We are global. We bring data that was otherwise unavailable to researchers. So we take care of bringing the data into the platform. Say more on that. We take care of the analytics and the technology and the software and the ways to interrogate the data and get insights from the data. And then if you want to use this platform, all you need is a login and a password. So it's almost like the Uber of clinical research. You don't need to know anything. You don't need to do anything. All you need to do is you need to be a member of the Trinetics network. And then you can be coming from an HCO or a hospital and interested in conducting research or from a pharma company. And you log in and that's it. You can now interact with data of hundreds of millions of patients from many, many countries in the world. We are in the US, Latin America, many countries in Europe, and many countries in Asia. And when I say we bring the data, so first always I say this disclaimer. If you ever meet a company in the field of data that tells you the data is perfect and can answer all your questions, just leave the room, run for your life, close the laptop, go make coffee. You know it cannot be true. So data in healthcare is such a journey. And it's such a humbling journey. So we have a very broad framework of data that we capture. You know, we take demographics, diagnosis, procedures, lab results, medications. We take genomics data. Most of the data we take is structured. We also deploy NLP to take unstructured data. We also buy data, claims data, and we link it to the data from hospitals. So just to make the point, the data is a very robust journey. Doesn't have a beginning, doesn't have an end. Always have to keep chasing more and more. And there's always something missing. So the only question is how to prioritize all those things that are missing, you know, and deploy capital and programs to chase them on a global scale.
So I want to get to all the things that are missing. Let's start at the beginning of this. So there's a chicken and egg question for data companies often that you need to get the data and clean it and put some analytics around it in order for it to be useful for customers. So nobody's going to pay you until you've done all of that. On the other hand, it can be hard to persuade people to license their data to you. And obviously, there's a lot of work in cleaning and linking those data sets, building those tools. So when you first arrive, what's the state of play? And, you know, at a macro level, what's the priority list look like back then?
Excellent question, Chris. So by the way, as much as I call myself a founder, I'm not a founder. Trinetics was started by Novartis and a very big biotech fund called MPM. And they hired a CTO and a small group of engineers just to see if that concept could actually become a reality. I was hired probably employee number 7, 6, 8, something like that in the early days as a CEO to build that business, if you will. And Trinetics, like many other businesses, and you said it right, is a chicken and the egg. Without HCOs, without data, there is no value to pharma. Without pharma, there is no value to the HCO. So where do you start? The answer is both. So we had Novartis, who was a founding father of this thing, and they helped us design and build it right. And then we went to hospitals, starting in the US, but very quickly started to expand outside of the US because it was global from day one, from a vision standpoint. And the concept of bringing real-time data, mostly from HCOs, in an anonymized way, de-identified way, secure way, HIPAA, GDPR compliant way, that's not new. So those concepts already been around, and a lot of early work was funded by government, but we were, I think, the first that came in and said, we want to build a sustainable model. We want to build a model where the life sciences industry is actually funding with revenues the creation of this platform. And then benefits for the hospitals, mainly two: A, getting the more clinical trials or chart reviews or paid work from pharma that is clinical research work. And the other benefit is giving those HCOs a bench for research that's much more powerful than anything they have. So those two promises were fulfilled, but we're working very hard to try and fulfill them more and more every day. So we're working very hard to give more business from pharma into the HCOs as they're building portfolios in clinical trials and clinical research and chart reviews. It's very important to fund the research part of an HCO so they can grow and build a beautiful, sustainable business. Not only it fuels research for the better of mankind, it also gives hope to their patients. Because a lot of time, really, the only thing you can offer a patient is some experimental therapy, if you will. So it's very important for hospitals to have a strong book of business with pharma of clinical trials. Lastly, it also helps them attract top physicians. Physicians that want to spend their time doing research, not just treating patients with the same thing over and over again. So overall, it's very good for hospitals to be participating in clinical research. And we provide them with a very robust way of doing that. So the value proposition for the HCO community is very strong. I say also with that, we honor and respect the privacy of the data, the privacy of the patients. The data is de-identified. It's all being anonymized. Nothing can identify back the patient. It is very important. We run those big analytics, AI, ML, on massive amounts of aggregated data. So there is a big HIPAA, big GDPR component. You know, we are a federated network. The data stays with the hospital for the most part. We provide a very strategic opportunity for hospitals to be big players in clinical research with pharma and life sciences companies. And on the other hand, they trust us with the de-identified and anonymized data that they have, and they know we'll do a good job to protect it. This is an asset that we take very seriously.
This makes a lot of sense to me. And so there's a question that venture capitalists will ask sometimes, that ask you, what is your unfair advantage over competitors or other folks that are trying to do something similar or might try to do something similar to what you're doing? When you think about what differentiates you, is it more about the nature of the relationships you've built with all of those organizations? Is it about your technology? And if so, is it more about the technology to clean and link and anonymize the data sets or the analytics? When you think about the things that really are special about what you guys are building, what's top of the list?
Excellent question. I ask myself that every day. And sometimes I like the answer, sometimes I don't. I'll tell you this. First of all, like any organization, first of all, I actually take a step back. The drug development industry, the life science industry, right? What is it? It's basically science in a capitalistic wrapper with a regulatory framework. That's all it is. So it's very complicated, you know, from a scientific standpoint, always cutting edge, bleeding edge, always a race to find more ways to save humans and cure disease and extend life and the quality of life. When I say capitalistic wrapper, you know, it's for the most part a for-profit industry. You know, companies are entrusted with the responsibility to develop life-saving therapies, and then they're being rewarded financially for doing that. And it's a very heavy regulated industry. And rightly so, because all those experiments, et cetera, at the end of the day, we're talking about human lives and ethics, and you have to regulate, because it's the one thing I learned from the military and ever, you just can't trust people to do the right thing. So that's the industry we are operating in. And now to, you know, strategic, sustainable, competitive advantages. First, I would say any competitive advantage has an expiration date on it, right? So thou shall never have a competitive advantage that will live forever. And the world is evolving so fast that I think all the advantages expire. But if you had to ask me what is kind of differentiates us, first, I think we have a very strong strategy that we were first in the game of building a global network platform for clinical research in a sustainable way. Another advantage, we always had great access to capital. We had amazing backers from day one, and they always participated in us. They always loved what we do. We were able to scale this strong strategy fast. So we were the first mover, I think, really. And we were moving really, really fast. So it's hard to catch up. Another big advantage we have, and I'll say this, always beware of people that say they're ethical. They're the most dangerous. We try to be the most ethical and conservative you can imagine. And we will give away deals, and we will move sometimes slower than we want. If we think anything on the trust side will be compromised, we will never do that. So we got our principles and priorities very straight, and honoring our customers' data and trust. And even where we were small, we were behaving like a big company from that aspect. A huge advantage is that we're global from day one. The complexity of healthcare data is something that I don't even have words to describe you. Even if you just take two of the same EMR installations in the US, they are very different in how they were installed. It's all custom stuff. And from a coding standpoint, et cetera, when it goes to labs, when it goes to genomics, it's really the wild, wild west. And there are reasons behind that. And a lot of good people working good time to make it better and easier. Now take this complexity, and I'll tell you, we signed contracts in more than 29 or 30 countries. So harmonizing data, not from two installations in the US, but harmonizing data in the US, in Brazil, in Japan, Germany, UK, Italy, Spain, Belgium, Israel. Oh my God, the level of complexity is ginormous. And we are good at that. That's what we do for 9 years now. The last thing I'll say, my people. Everybody says that, so it's going to sound, okay, it's just saying what everybody's saying. But I don't really care what everybody's saying. Sun Tzu, The Art of War, he said, love your soldiers like your sons, and they will die and kill for you. I love all my employees, literally, like they're my family. And we are very, very good in, we just have great people, great passion, and very smart. When someone responds to an email quickly versus other companies where it takes days or weeks, or sometimes you don't get an answer, boils down to that sometimes of why you win the business of your customers time and time again. And I know it sounds so naive, but it's not.
No, it doesn't sound naive to me at all. I think it's underestimated oftentimes how important those things are. I think that was a terrific list. If I summarize it, the core thing is trust. As long as you guys maintain the trust of all of the parties who are involved, the fact that you are first and you're fast and responsive means you've got what's hopefully a sustainable advantage. As you said, there are a lot of dead companies that thought they had permanent sustainable competitive advantage, but that's about all we can hope for, is something that looks strong in the now, right?
And yes, and I'll tell you, there's a strong passion. It's easy when you work in healthcare, but just to give you a small story, both my parents, they were together since high school. And at the end of life, they both died from pancreatic cancer. So we then just anecdotally responded to a request from a researcher in a very established HCO here in the Boston area and MIT. And they came to us and they said, what we knew, that, when you being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, especially above a certain age, but it's always true, it's a lot of times too late to really save your life. So we embarked in a really pro bono project with that research institution and MIT. We give the data, and they have actually identified markers that hint with some statistical significance that you may develop pancreatic cancer, even though you don't feel anything or you don't need to go and ask those questions that lead to that discovery, 12 months before diagnosis. So this is where your life could actually be saved. And we're now running, they actually registered the trial with some of our HCOs to prove that this could be indeed identified. And if it's going to work, what's going to come out from that is basically a scoring algorithm, Chris, that will score people and say everybody that scored above that are having X percent risk of they are developing pancreatic cancer right now. And by the way, if most of them don't, I don't care. It doesn't matter. But the few that are, you absolutely going to save their life just because you discover it earlier. If it works personally, this may save my life. We're doing this for us, It's so rewarding. And I always tell my people, you may be an engineer, you're writing a line of code in your room. Somewhere in the world, there is a mother that was just told she's not going to lose her son or daughter because of that code, because of the data that someone captured, because of the research that we facilitated. We probably see at any given time more than half of the drugs that are being developed on the planet any given time. All the large pharma working with us, large CROs. It's so rewarding to know that other than just running a company, the life-saving here is on a massive scale. It's hard to beat that excitement.
I think bringing that to life for people who are far from the patient is, I'm sure, very motivating for your teams. Gadi, when you think about what comes next in terms of data, what are the sorts of data that are most exciting to you?
It's such a good question. First of all, I would say that there is enough data existing now on our platform to push the development of drugs and shave years of that, 12 to 15 years that it takes to bring a drug to market, that the data is already there. Just come and use it. And then there's always the future and what you chase. And we're always excited about that. Our framework is a mile wide and a mile deep. So the answer is both, right? A mile wide is more countries, more patients, more diversity to be able to treat a diverse population of the world. You know, I'll give you an example. In the coding schema, in demographics, etc., people in the US may be comfortable classifying someone as Asian, coming from Asia. When you talk to researchers and when you talk to everyone, basically, they would laugh at you and say, it's not one thing. What are you talking about? It's so diverse. So a mile wide is very important to be able to include the world's populations and also, Chris, the world's best practices and practices of care. So the way care is practiced and what you're being prescribed and what's giving to you, etc., is very different. So to research those, you know, care practices in many different countries with many different diverse populations is what you got to go a mile wide. You just got to go a mile wide. Otherwise, you're much less relevant. And then the mile deep, that's obviously where so the mile wide is all about numbers. 100 million lives, 200 million lives, 500 million lives. It's a never-ending race. And then the mile deep is where the numbers become very small very quickly. A mile deep is where a cohort of 500 patients, where you know so much about and their journey, et cetera, this is, you know, very, very, very important. And so where you ask me what excites me, obviously, genomics data and the different types of genomics data that exist out there, you know, everything, microbiome and things like that, that are considered to be still new science. The problem, by the way, with those exotic type of data is that they're not being recorded. Yeah. There's no codes for them, you know, yeah, to say, what is this? What is that? They all, a lot of times, are not being even captured. You know, when COVID-19 started to happen, there was no code to catch COVID-19. So we were part of, you know, the community that basically designed and delivered those codes back into the hospitals quickly. And Trinetics was the first to catch those patients and show COVID-19 patients and don't show COVID-19 vaccinated patients and everything, every therapy that's being awarded to them. So going deep there, helping the world community craft the codes that are required in clinical research, everything that's scientifically exciting to make sure it goes to the standard of care from what data is being captured, at least. Chris, there's also a race for software analytics. We have a very robust platform that allows you to ask a lot of questions.
When you think about 5 years from now, do you envision that we will have, you know, five times as many disease codes as we have today? Is it about adding more codes or is it going to be more about natural language processing and tools to construe things from input that the doctors are making into the EHR?
Such a great question. We got to take care of it from the infrastructure standpoint, and I'll explain why. The main reason why clinical data is even being captured today is because hospitals and physicians need to get paid. That's the bottom line. So I think the marriage from an infrastructure standpoint with the needs of a researcher into the needs of a caregiver, and, you know, that is where the magic will happen, where all those things are going to be captured better and better. Then obviously better systems, you know, the ability to ask more questions, better discipline, the need to ask those questions, right? When you see a patient that you have to ask a bunch of things, otherwise you haven't fulfilled your duty as a caregiver, and understanding that the benefit of some of this data is not to manage patient X necessarily, but is to benefit the larger community. I had the pleasure and opportunity to ask Joe Biden one question when I met him. So I asked him, what would you think about sharing of patients' data? And, you know, his son, what would he think about sharing his data, you know, with the larger scientific community? My son would insist that his data would be shared for the greater good of mankind and to cure those diseases, and that there is a greater good in clinical research, and just to make the caregiving machine aware that there is another shadow ecosystem here that's thriving or dying based on what they do and how they feed it with data, and also educate the world how you can do that with great trust, fidelity. You just take care of the data, make it de-identified, make it anonymized, respect patient rights. And at the same time, if you don't feed the life sciences machine with data, it's just going to die. And it's going to basically hurt innovation, and patients going to die eventually.
You framed that really well. That makes a lot of sense. You were starting to move us into software, and I'll ask it as a question. Increasingly, we see examples of artificial intelligence or machine learning that are doing all kinds of interesting and incredible things. One of the things that people tend to say is building the algorithms is not actually the hardest part. The hardest part is having access to the data to train these tools on. You sit upon these huge repositories of data, so you're maybe one of the most well-positioned people we could talk to about where this is going. So how steep is the curve right now? How real do you think AI is? How has that changed over the last few years in your view?
It's such a great question. And I think we're catching it in Israeli, giving you now a baseball analogy. I may be wrong, but it's the second inning in the baseball game from, I'd say, AI, ML. And I think it's an industry that is of great promise and is absolutely extremely valuable when you're going through massive quantities of data, to have technology, very strong processing capacity, trying to make sense out of massive amounts of data, trying to find correlations between cohorts and reaction to drugs and therapies or lack of, and obviously huge place for AI, ML, and I love it. I would also say it's a side of the industry that's been hyped. A lot of times it had the flavor when it was young and early of a solution looking for a problem. So I'll give you an example. Natural language processing, NLP, you know, is a side of AI that appropriately so extracts data from unstructured data, from documents. We use it a lot. It's very valuable. It's extremely valuable. So this is a very simple form of AI. It creates massive value. And so we do it. We take structured data from hospitals and we take documents and we use AI to extract data from that. So that's an easy one to understand. And there's much more complicated ones, of course.
Has unstructured data, that data that you're extracting, has that become a larger, like a significantly larger percentage of what you guys are doing over the last, you know, 3-4 years?
I'd say the data asset, structured and unstructured, they both expand exponentially. First of all, the structured is one of those things where you plug and play, you install it once, and then it gets refreshed all the time. So it's just a beautiful way to always work with fresh data. And it's of usually higher quality because you run all your QA and all your tests, etc. And once you implement it, it's just running. And then the unstructured is just a longer road, if you will, but to much more data. There's much more data buried in the notes, and some of it is valuable, some of it not. Some of it is not valuable today, but will be valuable in the future. So with NLP, you always have to train the machine, and then it runs automatically. Every time you want to capture more, you go back to the notes and you capture it.
Fascinating. I hadn't thought about that. It makes a lot of sense that it's not just the utility that I'm getting today, but it's the utility for tomorrow that I can't anticipate now. Well, Gadi, I want to be respectful of your time. What a fascinating conversation. You are an extraordinary advocate for these data and these tools that are developing and becoming more and more widespread. You are an evangelist, of course, for Trinetics as well. So how can people get in touch with you? How can they learn more if they have questions?
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity. You are a like-minded good person, really trying to do the good things. It's like the writer of Lord of the Rings, Tolkien, said, all we have to do is decide what to do with the time that's given to us. So I think I hope we did something good with the hour you gave me. I'll say this, if people are interested in clinical research, getting access to data in massive quantities that goes very, very deep in a very secured, trusted environment, working at an HCO as a researcher, working at pharma, working at a CRO, we probably have what you need. And if we don't have what you need, we probably know how to get it or where to get it or not. But check us out, trinetics.com. And we will be very responsive and love to have a conversation and take it from there, you know, for the greater good of mankind and for the greater good and glory of the clinical research community, which is, it's just amazing.
I think that is the first time Tolkien has been quoted on this podcast. I hope it will not be the last time. Perfect timing as the new series is going live now. Gadi Lachman, CEO of Trinetics, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com.